Well, good morning, everybody. While we're waiting for the technology, let me ask, how many people in this room are somehow involved with prescription drug safety in one way or another? Okay, and so that's a good start. And how many people work in academia for the most part? Okay, how about for the pharmaceutical industry? All right, and how about for, say, a consumer health group? Or for, well, I think we're all consumers. I'm a consumer. But may perhaps work in an area where you're involved with a consumer or health advocacy group. Okay, that's pretty much most people. It was very hard for me to put this together because I really wasn't sure who was likely to come. And I have to tell you, when Stan gave me the impossible task of covering the legislation, I said, okay, let's not talk about the legislation. Let's talk about the pieces of the legislation that are relevant to drug safety, because the legislation is not only about drugs. And so I'm going to talk about drug safety from the perspective of the drug safety life cycle and try to emphasize that what we have the legislation really is doing is providing some tools to the Food and Drug Administration and others to help mature a framework for thinking about drug safety in the context of public health. I'll say a little bit about science, how we're implementing certain provisions of FDA, or the Food and FDA Amendments Act that Stan mentioned. I'm also going to talk about something called Safety First and Safe Use, and a little bit throughout this about communication. Now, Stan showed you a timeline, and there was a lot on that slide. I think one way to think about this is that from the 1980s to 2000, if you look, think about drugs, particularly prescription drugs, and their development in the United States, the real societal thrust was getting necessary medicines to patients who needed it. In the 1970s and in the early 1980s, most pharmaceutical development was happening overseas. Medical products were being approved in Europe and other places around the world much earlier than they were in the US. And so because of that pressure and the desire of the public to have access to medicines, the science in the US and the regulatory framework really focused on the clinical trial models for showing effectiveness and, from FDA's standpoint, how to conduct reviews more efficiently, faster, and assure the best access, which is the market. That began to change around the year 2000, give or take a few years, and our focus has really shifted to the safety of products that are always out there. We no longer have the great Petri dish, which is Europe, to tell us necessarily what safety issues are going to encounter so that we then don't approve the drug and spare the American public from the risks of, you know, potentially unnecessary risks. Because that really is the price that we paid in that shift back in the 80s and 90s. So now we have to think about safety more comprehensively, and there are other reasons why we do that, and I'll go into that. Now, the view from up high is really that since the onset of the FDA, you know, we initially, safety was about medical products and manufacturing quality. And in the last 3 or 4 decades, safety has really almost been a byproduct or side effect of evaluating clinical effectiveness in trials. There really wasn't a science of safety. And in fact, it was really the doctor and patient who were, you know, there was a buyer beware mentality. You know, you took a medicine, you were taking some risks. And that was pretty widely accepted in the medical, in the medical profession and among consumers. But as we have shifted to becoming a society where we not only rely on drugs to treat diseases, or signs and symptoms of a disease in, over a short period of time, where we rely on medicines to prevent disease, to maintain health, we have naturally seen a shift because people are taking medicines for life. And so the need to think about the longer term risks compared to benefits has really taken hold, and appropriately so. And so there are tools that, you know, if people have focused on to try and begin to think about this. Some of them are in the basic sciences, others are in clinical trials, and still others are in the field of epidemiology. And FDA is involved in interfacing, really, and utilizing the scientific tools that come from all of these areas. So, for example, in the preclinical sciences, I think that we're on the verge of genetics and genomics and how they affect how individuals metabolize drugs, how populations respond to drugs, things like drug receptor variability and the genetics around that. That is really going to be an important part of the safety science of the future. And we've already had some good examples where those tools have helped us identify which patients who take a particular drug are going to be the ones we have to worry about, who are going to be at risk for a toxicity of great concern. And also tools in clinical trials themselves and how they're conducted will be able to inform us better than ever. Now, FDA has actively sought to assure the growth of the science of safety assessment. And I would say this predates the legislation that Stan mentioned. It predates it going back 10, 15, 20 years. Our goal has shifted from just being able to describe toxicities of medicines to really understanding them, quantifying them, and helping particularly to understand who is at risk so that those people can be identified and those patients or people taking a medicine who are not at risk at all for a particular toxicity still have the benefit of being able to take a particular drug. We've employed tools of pharmacoepidemiology, as Stan mentioned. One of the big ones, and it was actually on his slide, is meta-analysis, the ability to pull safety information from a variety, from, you know, large numbers of clinical efficacy studies to look at safety in a larger population. I would say that is a double-edged sword. And we are still struggling with the plethora of methodologic issues and whether meta-analyses are signals that need to be further explored in clinical trials or whether they give an answer. And there's a lot of controversy about that that we could spend days on. We also established before this FDA legislation what's called the Critical Path Institute at FDA, where we seek to develop consortia of interested parties to bring data together from clinical trials already conducted so that we can better understand what they're telling us across products. I will say, however, that those are all scientific activities. And what we have been frustrated with over the past 10, 15 years is that facilitation by engaging the science at FDA has not been enough for us to be able to really seize the public health role in assuring drug safety. And long in advance of FDA's passage, FDA was feeling this, but ultimately it was the Congress who recognized that what FDA needed in order to really ensure that the scientific tools are well employed was more authority. As the science has been developing, in parallel, there have been a number of big, you know, very public issues related to drug safety that finally spurred the Congress to act. And we think that there, and I will say from our standpoint, we welcomed the new authority. And I have on the right-hand side of the slide some of the issues that really drove this and were in the public eye. The Vioxx market withdrawal, which really focused on when does someone tell the public about a new safety risk, the suicidality risk for children on antidepressants, the FDA's growing dependence on funds by the industry in the way of user fees for doing its job. User fees were a wonderful thing designed to supplement the American taxpayers' investment in drug safety, but what happened was that as soon as the user fees came into play, the administration and Congress started pulling the funding, the appropriated taxpayer funding, out from underneath until we were almost wholly reliant on user fees. And also the Institute of Medicine's report on drug safety. The FDA Amendments Act that Stan mentioned, you know, it's an elephant. It's enormous. I'm going to say a little bit about the tools that I end up being involved with most frequently, which are, in of the 11 titles, Title IX. And I would say that the way to think about this, and Stan alluded to it, is that we have not seen drug legislation or regulation that has the potential to affect such a magnitude of change in public health since 1962. In 1962 was when the FDA efficacy amendments came into being, when it was required that drugs had to be demonstrated to be effective in order, in addition to safe, in order to be marketed. This is enormous, and we are learning as we go. The tools that Title IX provides for are risk evaluation and minimization strategies that the agency can require companies to put in place in order to market drugs. We can require certain safety label changes. That was the lesson of Vioxx, a year and a half of negotiating in order to get the information about concerns about cardiovascular safety into the label. This will fix that. It does fix it. And the ability to require certain post-marketing studies, certain post-marketing clinical trials, in order to answer safety questions that weren't answered in the original trials. FDA also establishes this system of active surveillance called Sentinel, using a large number of healthcare claims databases. Well, what have we done so far? FDA was passed in September 2007. Many of the provisions did not take place until the spring and summer of 2008. So in terms of study requirements, we have issued 21 letters for new drugs since as of in the year 2008, as of the 30th of September, specifically requiring studies for 21 drug products. Some of them are clinical trials. Some of them are epidemiology studies. Some of them are certain preclinical studies or animal studies, but 21 letters over a period of about 6 months. That's an enormous number of required clinical required studies. For the risk evaluation and mitigation strategies, we have issued since, I believe it's March, no, so June, 13 new requirements for risk evaluation and mitigation strategies, new ones. There are some that things that were already in place that were converting into REMS, but these are the brand new ones. 11 of them are pretty basic. They're just requirements for medication guides, which are patient information leaflets that must be distributed verbatim to patients at the time a prescription is dispensed. But several of them are much more complex, with measures to assure safe use that involve prescribers, patients, or both, and even in one case, enrollment of patients into specific programs. As far as requiring labeling changes, we've used this authority 4 times, each one for a class of drugs, not just an individual product. These are all drugs already on the market. The first one, and I think probably the watershed one, was for erythropoietin-stimulating agents, or ESAs, and you've got two logos on the slide for the two big products, two of the big products in the U.S. These are biologic therapeutics that are administered parenterally, and they are approved for the treatment of anemia that develops because of cancer chemotherapy. These products were being used as part of chemotherapy cocktails before patients became anemic. They were being used and marketed as drugs to stimulate chemotherapy patients' energy, make them feel better. They may as well have been in the water supply. And data have been growing over the past 6 to 10 years that clearly demonstrate in certain situations that use of these drugs, particularly for a long term, they are not intended for long term use, is associated with cancer growth. And so we used our first use of this new authority was to address labeling for these products. Now, improving the post-marketing drug surveillance system is certainly something that predates FDA. I'm not going to say too much about it other than that we have are trying to redesign our adverse event reporting system, particularly to make it easier for physicians and patients to report adverse events, as well as partner with the NIH so that their information is collected on adverse events in clinical trials is in the same format that post-marketing safety information is, so that the databases can be used to talk to each other. Stan already mentioned the Sentinel Initiative. This is a large claims claims databases and electronic health records that will allow us to get a better sense of not only of what safety signals are arising for products on the market, but also who's using them, how are drugs being used. And all of this information is being put together in a way that has a multitude of firewalls to protect individual patient data. What FDA does is it requires FDA to have a database of the size with 25 million patient records by the year 2010 and on from there. And FDA also put in place a specific foundation to oversee this. Now, finally, I want to pull this all together by saying that these are all tools that have come in, that have, you know, been put into the FDA's hands in order to really meet the public health needs of doing a better job of describing, assuring, quantifying, and communicating information about drug safety. But something has to pull it all together, and that's our job internally, and we've been doing that by an initiative internally called Safety First, and we'll be launching something called Safe Use in the near future. These are umbrella activities designed to link everything and provide our own staff with a framework for using all these different tools. For Safety First, the idea here is to move us into an environment where, from a work standpoint, we are ensuring that all of these pieces of the safety puzzle are getting the same priority as assessing the efficacy of drugs coming to the market. Our job is to be comprehensive. And one of the ways that we are doing that is we have developed our own new system that internally tracks post-marketing safety issues, just like we track user fee goal dates for new drug applications. In my office, the Office of New Drugs, we have 17 new product review divisions by clinical therapeutic area. In each of those new drug review divisions, we have assigned, we create a new position, a deputy director for safety, to coordinate all of our safety activities related to the medical products in that clinical therapeutic area. We've also, we are in many of those cases adding other staff to that team because their workload is quite large. In our Office of Surveillance and Epidemiology, we're growing the staff and growing the science and beginning to sort out very deliberately how to create centers of excellence within the agency for specific skills and abilities to assess and weigh in on unique aspects of safety. What the public will see more than Safety First is they're going to see a new initiative coming out in January 2009 called Safe Use. And that is really intended to extend the information that we have and the findings that we uncover and the thinking that the scientific community may be aware of out into the world of consumers. You know, the majority of, despite all these interesting things about unique toxicities of drugs, it remains the case that the majority of harm from approved drugs comes from misuse, inappropriate use, and medical errors. And it is essential that knowledge about this, and as well as about, you know, the actual toxicity profile of a drug, have close, timely interface with the healthcare system. And one of the challenges that FDA had back in the 20th century that we were constantly frustrated by is that we did not have a voice in the public domain. We only spoke about safety issues, efficacy issues, or anything related to drugs through the industry. I remember when I came to FDA, I thought that was really strange. But we never said anything. It was only the companies who spoke. That has changed and is continuing to change, but in order to influence the healthcare system, not oversee or regulate the healthcare system, but to influence it, we have to have a voice. And we are trying to find ways to have such a voice responsibly and with measure. The way we're doing to finally to address all this, how are we doing this? Well, we have hired in our center over 650 people in the year 2008. This is absolutely unprecedented growth. We are now a center of about 3,000 people, with 650 of them being new. We have a lot of training ahead of us. Most people who come to work at FDA do not come fully trained. There is a lot to learn. It's a very unique place. That's okay. And we have to also continue to make sure that the staff that we do have, even those who have been there for a long time like me, are learning constantly and staying on the cutting edge of the science and understanding how they interface with the bigger picture. Whether that's interfacing with the scientific community, health policy, or the regulated industry. So in summary, I think what FDA tells is, FDA itself, or the legislation, is that the field of drug safety is growing. The new science is burgeoning. There's laboratory science, preclinical science. I think we're getting a lot smarter about clinical trials, not only how to assess effectiveness, but also how to bring safety assessments into those clinical trials, and doing a better job of coordinating all the sources of information that are out there about safety of drugs. The FDA itself has more staff and more authority to try to assure drug safety. And one question that the title of this session asked is, are we better off? I think the resounding answer is absolutely. We are better off today than we were a year ago, and certainly better off than we were 10 years ago, and I think a year from now and a year after that, we will continue to be better off. The one question that has been raised to us, and I'll leave that for your thoughts, is, does this mean that the FDA is too conservative? And you can define that any way that you wish. And I don't know that there is an answer, but it's something to think about. Thank you.